In addition, these Republican appointees are openly shooting down Democratic efforts to fight gerrymandered maps while supporting GOP efforts to impose them on states. Is there no way to paraphrase Shakespeare to rid ourselves of this court's corrupt behavior? Turns out Congress has that power, although they haven't used it since Ulysses Grant was president and reorganized the court. Article 3rd of the Constitution establishes the federal court system and gives to Congress itself the power to create the lower federal courts. It also says that the Supreme Court judges may only serve on the court if they behave themselves. It also requires Congress to regulate the Supreme Court. Article 3rd, Section 2 says the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. The issue of Supreme Court needing regulation from the first among equals legislative branch, Congress, as specified by the founders and framers of the constitutions, has been with us for 121 years. Most people remember William Howard Taft as the one-term progressive Republican president who followed Teddy Roosevelt into the White House in 1909 and was beaten for re-election by Woodrow Wilson in 1912. But after his retirement from the presidency, Taft became the first former president to serve as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1921. He was the 27th president and 10th Chief Justice of the U.S. In 1921, it came to the attention of the nation and to Chief Justice Taft that U.S. District Judge Landis was taking five times his annual salary as a judge from what was then called organized baseball 5 years after ruling in their favor. The scandal provoked Congress to pass in 1922 a law creating a body that would provide advice and oversight to the federal judiciary. It came to be known as the Judicial Conference of the United States. The scandal also prompted Chief Justice Taft to accept the unpaid chairmanship of the American Bar Association, newly formed commission to write ethics rules for federal judges. Taft's commission wrote in 1923 the first canons of judicial ethics, which included 34 categories of judicial conflicts and misbehavior that would either disqualify a judge or require their recusal from cases before them. They included conflicts of interest, personal, financial investments, and even behavior in the courtroom itself. Taft, in delivering the canons, made it clear they should apply to all federal courts, including his own Supreme Court. Within a decade, every state in the Union had adopted the canons for their own courts. The canons, however, had no enforcement mechanism, particularly when it comes to the Supreme Court. After all, who would judge the highest court in the land? That opened the door for literally a century of the Supreme Court ignoring Taft work. The issue came to the fore again in 1969 when Republicans went nuts when it was revealed that Justice Abe Fortas, a very liberal, Republicans call him a communist, LBJ appointee, had taken $15,000 for a summer teaching post, was receiving time-delayed payments from a law former client, and worst of all, was secretly advising President Johnson. Under massive incoming fire from Republicans and their friendly media, Fortas resigned from the Supreme Court on May 14, 1969. Over the next 3 years, the ABA put together a new commission to update Taft's original canon on judicial ethics. That commission released their new code of judicial conduct in 1972, and it was adopted by the Judicial Conference of the United States in 1973. The Supreme Court, however, chose to ignore it, arguing that they were above such considerations. By that time, the Supreme Court had made itself as we lay out in detail in the hidden history of the Supreme Court and the betrayal of America, the most powerful of the three branches of government, asserting power to second-guess both Congress and the president. Ironically, in his 2011 annual report about the state of the judiciary, Chief Justice John Roberts made lengthy and effusive reference to former Chief Justice Taft and his work with the APA's Commission on Judicial Ethics. His report, however, conveniently omitted the fact that Taft had loudly and publicly asserted it should apply to the Supreme Court. Instead, Roberts noted rhetorically, "Some observers have recently questioned whether the Judicial Conference's code of conduct for United States judges should apply to the Supreme Court." We will spare you extended quotes from Roberts' report, which you can read later. But the bottom line is that, in his opinion, the court can tell the 1923 ethics recommendations and the subsequent ones from 1973 to go screw themselves. The Supreme Court, in his mind, is answerable to nobody but itself. As Sam Alito said, "I'm not aware of problems on the Supreme Court itself. We would not sit back. We would take action that's appropriate." Most recently, Senator Chris Murphy introduced the Supreme Court Ethics Act that would seek to regulate the court out of control, politicking, and conflicts of interest. Predictably, it was blocked by Republicans in the Senate. Public outrage is building. The court's approval rating is now around 40%, a historic low. Congress needs to act, requiring them to adopt and conform to the Federal Code of Judicial Ethics at the very least, and expand the court at best, before an entire branch of government sinks into an irredeemable partisan muck of corruption.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss a deep sense of insecurity growing across Kashmir, and Bangladesh's two options, India or China.
Insecurity is growing in Kashmir, and the local media these days is full of reports of killings of civilians, suspected terrorists, and security forces. Usually, after such incidents, there are massive operations in which up to hundreds of people are arrested and imprisoned, with some of them found dead in jails or on the streets or even in the jungles. However, tightening up security across Kashmir has not been helpful. There are attacks even in Srinagar's crowded markets. Now, let's take a closer look at some of the recent incidents.
There's hundreds of Kashmiris at the farewell for 20-year-old Rafia Nazir. It was a great sorrow for the family to lose the sharp, sensitive and bright girl. She was determined to become a doctor and pull her family out of poverty, but her life and family's hope were cut short. Rafia became a victim of a grenade blast in Amira Kadal as she and her mother were passing the crowded marketplace in central Srinagar in early March. Rafia, who suffered a serious brain injury, succumbed to her wounds the day after. Amira Kadal's attack took the lives of Rafia and an elderly man and wounded 33 others. Kashmir was once regarded the world's most dangerous place. Despite heightened security measures, civilians are subjected to various kinds of offences, not only by suspected militants, but also Indian forces. In one occasion, they arrested more than 1,000 people on suspicion of connection with what they later termed unauthorized groups last October. There are also reports that the security forces used defenseless civilians as human shields during search operations or even violent encounters with protesters or suspected terrorists. This is similar to people's everyday life being caught in the middle.
Large gatherings or Indian armed forces are targeted, but such attacks are not rare in Indian-administered Kashmir. Local officials often criticize Indian forces for their failure to protect civilian lives. They say, at the end of the day, this is the defenseless people who pay the price of insecurity. Of Indian forces' heavy security restrictions, people experience the heavy restrictions to the bones, but not the security. So, are these just fresh attempts to disrupt the social harmony in Kashmir?
Kashmir has been divided between India and Pakistan since their partition in 1947. Both Islamabad and New Delhi claim Kashmir in full, and they fought over Kashmir three times. The Indian side of the region has been the scene of constant clashes between security forces and freedom fighters seeking Kashmir's independence or its merger with Pakistan. This has ravaged Kashmir for decades. New Delhi is increasingly using its anti-terror law since the Hindu Nationalist Party, BJP, came to power in 2014. The government of Narendra Modi amended the anti-terror law in 2019. It enabled the authorities to accuse individuals and organizations of terrorism. Thousands of Kashmiris have been imprisoned since the law was passed. Moreover, New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in 2019, turning the bad situation to worse. Later, New Delhi amended the land laws, permitting any Indian to buy land in Indian-administered Kashmir. This made Kashmiris skeptical of New Delhi's intentions of settling outsiders and changing the demographic of the Muslim-majority region. With the BJP's coalition retaining power in the recent assembly elections, Muslims who have already suffered citizenship laws and hijab ban under the ruling party's cultural nationalism policy are now worried more about their security.
Now, to have more insight on the growing insecurity in Kashmir, we are joined by Ahmed Bilghasim, a Kashmiri writer and journalist. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Bilghasim. Now, how do you view using civilian Kashmiris by Indian security forces as human shields in terms of human rights?
So the first thing that we have to understand when we speak about the use of human shields by the Indian state in Kashmir is that for the Indian state, Kashmiris, especially Kashmiri Muslims, are inherently and innately killable. Their bodies are dispensable, their lives have no value, and human shields is just one way of Indian state violating international law and international humanitarian law. And it also goes on to show us that the Indian state really does not care about how it is perceived by the international community. It violates international laws because it knows that there is going to be no concrete accountability about what it does in Kashmir. So there are instances of use of human shields by the Indian state, but it happens on a scale that is way more frequent than people usually think. So for example, in many cases, every single time the Indian state tries to engage in an armed encounter of Kashmiri freedom fighters who are trapped in a house, usually what they do is that they take a Kashmiri, at times even the family members of the people who are trapped inside the house, and then they place the gun on their shoulders, and then they start walking towards the house so that the other party is not able to fire at the Indian occupational forces because you place their own family members in front of them, and they're not going to fire knowing that it might well go on to kill someone from their own family. So this is how the Indian state has operated in Kashmir, not just after the BJP came into power, but we have instances of human shields used before the rise of BJP into power. It has been happening ever since the 1990s.
Mr. Bin Qasim, how do you believe the insecurity in Kashmir mounted after region's special status was revoked by New Delhi?
So I would not actually agree with that assessment, because the problem in Kashmir, many a times people argue that what we see in Kashmir is a condition of lawlessness, and therefore for them lawlessness stands as a kind of anomaly to a normal and steady rule of law. The thing is that the people of Kashmir are not fighting for regime change. They're not fighting for a different political party coming into power. It's very important for us to remember that what they're fighting for is complete self-determination. What they're fighting for is complete freedom. So if you see how Kashmir was before 2014, before the BJP came into power, you will notice that even at the time of Indian National Congress, even when there was a secular nationalist party ruling Kashmir, the scale of human rights violations was not low at all. So you had arbitrary detentions, you had massacres, you had the use of rape as a weapon of war. All of these things have been happening in Kashmir since 1947. Now, when you ask about the question of the revocation of Article 370, the only reason why the people of Kashmir are anxious about it, because they feel that this revocation transforms the military occupation of Kashmir into an instance of, into a structure of settler colonization. So they believe that as the Indian state has revoked Article 370, and now it has allowed non-Kashmiris to settle in Kashmir, they believe that this marks a transformative point in the history of Kashmir, where the Indian state seeks to change the demography of Kashmir and render the Kashmiri Muslims into a minority in their own homeland. So that is the only reason why Kashmiris feel very deeply anxious about the revocation of Article 370.
So how do you think the Muslim majority Kashmir would react to the election result?
So for the Muslims of Kashmir, you see, the idea is that after the BJP came into power, what you see happening with the Muslims in mainland India right now, first of all, starting with the CAA-NRC problem, and now the entire controversy around hijab, and now it's wearing hijab has been banned in schools. Many people, they're very surprised by these moves because of the fact that Kashmir has, for the most part, been invisibilized from the conversation. So everything that you see happening in India at the moment against the Muslims in India has been happening against the Muslims of Kashmir for a long, long time. So, for example, the major mosque in Kashmir, referred to as the Jamia Mosque, has been shut down for months on. You have religious educational institutes that have been shut down. You have religious scholars who have been jailed. You have a blatant Islamophobia that constitutes India's juridical and legal framework in Kashmir. So when Kashmiris see the BJP winning elections and retaining power, naturally it signals that things are only going to get worse for them. Though I should add here that even if the BJP were to lose the elections and you had some other party coming into power, maybe it would have changed things for people living in India. But for the people of Kashmir, it would not have changed a lot. With the BJP, the thing is that they have this explicit, outward, visible agenda of Hindu supremacy, and they're working in Kashmir towards institutionalizing it, forcing Kashmiri Muslims to chant slogans of Hinduism, forcing them to recite hymns of Hinduism. So that cultural imperialist project is already going on.
Mr. Bin Qasim, do you believe the hardline Hindus' boosting of power could mount to more insecurity in Kashmir?
Yes, absolutely. With the Hindu nationalist government, the BJP retaining power, there's going to be a greater insecurity in Kashmir, because they have a very clear agenda. They have this very clear goal, not since 2014, but if you go through and you read the works of their intellectual forefathers, even in the 1930s and 40s, they had declared that the solution to the Kashmir problem in 1940s, they had declared, lies in the fact that Kashmiri Muslims, who constitute the majority in Kashmir at the moment, have to be rendered into a minority by settling Hindus in Kashmir. They know, so long as Kashmiris constitute the majority in Kashmir, Kashmiri Muslims, naturally the movement for self-determination cannot be crushed. People's political consciousness cannot be crushed through economic incentives, through oppression, through different modalities of power. So what the Indian state is going to do as the BJP retains power is that, first of all, they are going to settle the ex-army men in Kashmir. They are going to settle their children in Kashmir. They are going to settle laborers in Kashmir. They are going to take away the resources of Kashmiris and bring in Indian investors, give them lands of the Kashmiri people, force the Kashmiri people to vacate their lands. So naturally, with the BJP retaining power, another 5 years of extreme oppression and repression are lying ahead for the Kashmiris.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Bin Qasim for being on the program. Now let's go to social media, where insecurity in Kashmir is a hot topic, with the reports receiving huge attention.
Umar Ishaq Bhatt blasts the BBC for branding people as terrorists in Kashmir, but calling those fighting Russia freedom fighters. Qamar Mehdi accuses India of state terrorism to suppress people of Kashmir and control their disputed land. Ashok Pandit is the pro-BJP president of the Indian Film and Television Directors Association. He's shared images of the funeral of Rafia Nazir and said her innocence and mourners' wails and cries will always be remembered.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Bangladesh became independent in 1971. It was largely devoid of natural resources and born extremely poor, with the average income of $90 per person. It, however, has earned kudos worldwide as an economic success story in recent years. Each Bengali is now making more than $2,000 a year on average. Along with its economy, Bangladesh is also boosting its military power. It purchases most of its military needs from China, making Bangladesh independent from its larger and more resourceful neighbors.
China is setting up an overhaul facility for FM-90 surface-to-air missile systems in Bangladesh. The missile system was supplied by China over a decade ago. Vanguard is the Chinese company selected as the partner of this maintenance hub. FM-90 is a truck-mounted air defense system. It is an improved version of the Hongqi China produced first in 1998. FM-90 is an anti-aircraft system capable of operations against all types of flying objects, such as planes, missiles, or drones. Its radar system can lock onto the objects within 25 kilometers. The missiles are fired when the objects are at the distance of 16 kilometers. FM-90 is able to operate against multiple targets. It can simultaneously launch missiles to hit multiple objects, including ultra-low-altitude cruise missiles, air-to-surface missiles, and anti-radiation missiles. The maintenance facility deal is set to double up the production assembly lines of the missile and its variants. Even though the deal on the maintenance hub has been announced neither by China nor Bangladesh, the media report the two countries have finalized the agreement. Russia's special operation in Ukraine and the security balance in the Asia-Pacific region have complicated the announcement of the deal.
Bangladesh is surrounded on three sides by India, while the fourth side is the Bay of Bengal. But from New Delhi's point of view, Bangladesh is almost choking India, connecting to its remote northeastern land. This, together with buying Chinese arms, Bangladesh is seen to become a game changer of the region. The Beijing-Dhaka military partnership has not posed any existential threats to India, but India is fiercely pushing Bangladesh to limit its trade with China. So, the question remains, what is making India so horrified?
China supplies most of Bangladesh's military needs, which were worth some $1.2 billion from 2016 to 2020. The maintenance facility of the FM-90 is a part of a defense cooperation treaty signed by China and Bangladesh in 2002. The military treaty also includes warships, naval guns, anti-ship missiles, and military personnel training. In 2016, Bangladesh boosted its naval power by obtaining two submarines from China at the cost of $203 million. In addition to military cooperation, the traditional ally of India has also strengthened its economic relations with China. Bangladesh joined China's Belt and Road Initiative in 2016, and China granted it virtually tariff-free access to its markets. Dhaka's look at Beijing has worried India, which views Bangladesh as its backyard. Especially, India has expressed concern over the recent FM-90 facility agreement. In spite of the fact that New Delhi is strengthening its own outreach to Dhaka by providing a credit line for Indian arms, Bangladesh has refused to join the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, which is an informal anti-China military pact comprising India, Japan, Australia, and the US. It seems Bangladesh, which considers itself a close ally of India, likes to maintain its close commercial and military ties with China.
And now Professor Sanjay K. Bharadwaj, the chairperson of Center for South Asian Studies at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, is now joining us to shed more light on Dhaka's look at Beijing. Now, first of all, welcome to the program, Professor. Now, let's begin with your view on Bangladesh's strategy of the growing military partnership with China.
Look, Bangladesh has quite fair relations with China on the defense cooperation. You can see since 1975, when the military regime was there in Bangladesh, they had developed close defense partnership, particularly in 1980s, while they opened a small arms factory in Jaipur in Dhaka, near Dhaka. Now, in 2002, I would say that while Khalida Zia was in power, China and Bangladesh, they have signed a defense umbrella cooperations, where the maintenance and production of the defense arms that Bangladesh will cooperate with China. In 2011 also, that the Chinese, they have given a missile. So they are in good terms for, you can say, in the last 4 decades.
Professor, do you think India is right to be worried about China's missile maintenance deal in Bangladesh?
I don't think that, the first thing, there is a news from Nikki report, but it is not certified, because Bangladesh foreign minister declined that there were any deal related to the maintenance of missile. And I'm sure that Bangladesh is well aware about the consequences of having any kind of military or missile maintenance deal with China, because Bangladesh is and India has same or a similar strategic interest in the region, and whatever the development, defense developments, and any kind of cooperations take place with Bangladesh, it has a spillover impact on India's security, as well as if India do something with in case of in this region, it has the same implications for Bangladesh. So my point is there that Bangladesh is geostrategically very important for India, And I'm sure that Bangladesh would not go for any kind of or take any kind of initiative that would adversely impact on India's strategic interest. And if there would be any deal between China and Bangladesh, I'm sure Bangladesh government would definitely have consultation with India. So Chinese, they are definitely looking these countries as a market for their arms and technology. But how much it would be worth for Bangladesh to have defense or missile maintenance agreement with China, I don't think it would be worth to go for this deal.
Obviously, China and Bangladesh are sovereign states. Can any third country object to the military partnership between the two countries?
No, I'm sure they are sovereign states, of course, but in the sovereignty also, while the geographically, you know, Bangladesh and India is a proximate country. And while you will see that we are part of common ecological organic system, and if there are any problems, any security issues arise with vis-a-vis Bangladesh would have adverse impact on India. And if anything, as I said earlier also, so the sovereignty question definitely that is larger than the regional security question is larger than the national security. And if Bangladesh is inviting and bringing any extra regional power that has adverse impact on the regional security, would definitely the end country would not like it. If the, like in case of Sri Lanka also, the Chinese were developing Habantota port, but if it has deeper strategic and security implications for India, India was concerned about the same thing. So my point is there, the regional security issues are more important than the national security, particularly keeping India and South Asian countries' proximity.
There you go, Professor Bharadwaj from Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. Thank you, Professor, for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see what the users on social media think about the Beijing-Dhaka relations.
Murshid is a Dhaka-based user who shares images of Chinese warplanes purchased by Bangladesh. Anu Anwar is a Harvard University scholar who says China's making a missile overhaul facility in Bangladesh is not a threat to India.
And that was our episode covering tensions in Kashmir and Bangladesh's look at China. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In Lock Steps with Spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
In the limelight.
Gazan farmers fear a season of ruined crops and the long-term consequences of the Zionist regime's ongoing practice, says Maha Hosseini, writer, in an article titled Zionist Regime Carries Out Aerial Spraying of Herbicides Near Palestinian Farmlands. Stay tuned for more. For 4 days in a row, the Zionist regime crop duster planes have been flying near the eastern Gaza Strip, spraying chemicals believed to be herbicides in close to Palestinian lands adjacent to the border fence. The frequency of the spray is determined by the direction of the wind. Eyewitnesses say, adding that the spray stops when it rains or when the wind blows in the opposite direction. The only start is spraying along the border fence when the wind blows west in the direction of the Palestinian lands in order to allow the herbicides to cover a larger area inside our lands, Palestinian farmer Yusuf Abu Maqadid told Middle East Eye recently, adding, but when the wind starts blowing east, they immediately stop because it would harm them. In Gaza, around 40,000 Palestinians depend on farming as their only source of livelihood. Maqadid estimates that the latest spraying was conducted over at least 60 hectares of farmland, directly affecting the livelihood of 35 to 40 farmers. The Zionist regime army regularly claims that the herbicides are used to clear vegetation in the buffer zone in Gaza side of the fence in order to have a clearer view of the area for military purposes. But Palestinians say the policy inflicts wide-ranging damage on the residents of Gaza. Maqadid accused the Zionist regime authorities of intentionally damaging Palestinian crops in the eastern farmlands using various tactics over the years. He said, "We have been going through the same scenario for years now. Every couple of weeks, they send drones to spray our lands to damage the crops so that they can monitor the area more clearly. Sometimes this happens only a few days before the harvest season. You can imagine the amount of losses we endure." Aside from the spraying of herbicides, Palestinian farmers also have to deal with the constant firing of tear gas by the Zionist regime forces deployed along the border fence in eastern Gaza. Maqadid said, just today alone, the Zionist regime forces fired more than 10 tear gas canisters at shepherds to keep them away from the buffer zone. But the wind blows the gas towards us and we have to leave our land several times a day to avoid inhaling it. This happens on a daily basis and several times a day. According to rights groups, the Zionist regime has been conducting aerial herbicide spraying in this area for several years, and the activity is typically carried out without prior notification or warning to Palestinian farmers. The Zionist regime carries out the spraying when the wind is blowing westward, which transports the chemicals deep into Gaza, reaching distances as far as 1,200 meters into the strip, activists say. Since 2014, the clearing and bulldozing of agricultural and residential lands by the Zionist regime military close to the eastern border of Gaza has been completed by unannounced aerial spraying of crop-killing herbicides, the research group Forensic Architecture found in 2019. The London-based agency spent over a year examining the environmental and legal implications of the Zionist regime practice of aerial spraying of herbicides along the Gaza border. The agency said in a statement, "This ongoing practice has not only destroyed entire swathes of formerly arable land along the border fence, but also crops and farmlands hundreds of meters deep into the Palestinian territory, resulting in the loss of livelihoods for Gazan farmers." Farmers would not see the full scope of damage caused by herbicides until days or weeks after the spraying activity, said Iyad Abu Qalba. "We still cannot determine if the spraying has incurred any damage to the crops. It usually takes up to 8 to 10 days until dark spots start appearing on the leaves. And this is when we know that they are damaged and cannot be harvested," the local farmer told MEE. "We are supposed to harvest the crops, including peppers, carrots, and wheat in the next 2 or 3 months. If the herbicides have indeed affected the crops, which we will know in around a week, then the whole season is ruined and tens of thousands of dollars are lost, Buchelbaugh said. As a result, many farmers are facing increasing debts due to the Zionist regime's continuous practice aimed at damaging Palestinian crops, Buchelbaugh added. The situation worsened when the Zionist regime attacked Gaza in May 2021, leading to an estimated loss of $204 million in Gaza's agricultural sector, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Agriculture. Buchelbaugh said, "We are still struggling with the consequences of the last attack on Gaza that causes us huge damage due to the shelling and leveling of lands, as well as abandoning the crops throughout the 11 days of the attack and then having to deal with the Zionist regime's decision to close the borders and prevent exports. We are not ready for another year in which our agricultural lands are targeted continuously."
Economic divide.
The crisis between Russia and Ukraine has wreaked havoc in global oil markets. Russia plays a pivotal role in the global energy supply, and destabilization could send shockwaves to the global economy. It is the third biggest producer of oil in the world, behind the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Produces around 7 million barrels of oil per day, which is about 7% of global oil supply. Russian imports account for 8% of total U.K. oil demand. More than 40% of what it produces every day goes to Europe. The U.S. is less reliant, with about 3% of its imported oil coming from Russia. Oil prices have reached their highest levels in years. Experts warn sanctions on Russia's energy products could be catastrophic for the global economy. They say the global economy could be facing one of the largest energy supply shocks ever. There are now warnings that prices of oil per barrel could reach $180 to $200.
Here in the United States, I mean, we've imported 200,000 barrels a day. We imported about 450,000 barrels of product, mostly unfinished distillate, that we run through the refinery to boost yields on the other end of the refinery. It comes out more distillate, more gasoline. We don't really need those 200 barrels. We don't need those 450,000 barrels. So we can definitely exist without that. It's a spit in the bucket. The Eurozone, we're talking percentage points, double digits. So it's a totally different game.
Russia has already warned that prices could reach $300 per barrel if the West decides to shun its oil and gas from the markets. Supply shortages, bottlenecks, and price pressures caused by the coronavirus pandemic have already disrupted the global economy, and there are fears that further price shocks would have catastrophic consequences.
The whole notion of sanctioning a country is to make the governing body suffer, and not the ordinary citizens. But that may not be the case when it comes to the U.S. in particular, than the Europeans. Let's see what people had to say about that in our social media section of the program. Well, this person has the right idea, even though the U.K. is too entrenched in this already. The U.K. should stay out of the Russia-Ukraine war, apart from that, to de-escalate and then try to bring the fighting to an end. Do not enact a no-fly zone, do not send weapons, and stop ramping up sanctions against all of Russia. That only hurts ordinary people rather than what he or this person says is the regime there. Next one, what a display of duplicity and hypocrisy of Europe's leaders. How can they expect Russia to supply gas, fuel, while their non-military entities, artists, sportspersons, ordinary people are being hit by sanctions? How will Germany or Hungary pay for energy with no SWIFT links? Next one, we do not support Joe Biden's sanctions on Russia. Sanctions will only hurt ordinary Americans by further hiking up gas prices. Biden's already slashed domestic production and the Saudis have declined to raise output. Well, this new sanctions package will cripple America, not Russia. And finally, you're hurting Americans at the pump. Your sanctions are going to hurt us more than Russia. And the only ones in Russia that would be hurt are ordinary people there, just like the ones that you're hurting here at home. Open up the pipelines and drop all federal fuel taxes. Okay, some of the social media posts which seem to agree with us in terms of how ordinary people are suffering. Okay, joining us in this segment of the Q&A is Attilio Boron. He's a political scientist and international analyst who joins us from Buenos Aires. Attilio Boron, welcome. We're taking a look at, obviously, what has happened with this conflict, Russia's military operation, which has shocked the oil markets. Looking for replacements has been something that the U.S. is after, but it hasn't been successful. In the meantime, obviously, Europe is wanting to go with the U.S., but finding a replacement for oil and gas is a tough thing. What is your assessment as to whether this can be done to help the ordinary people who are suffering the most here?
Not at all. They're very hungry and thirsty of consuming oil, so there will be no problem for the Russians. Of course, there will be necessary to make some adjustments in all the pipelines which Russia has developed, but there is no question that they could divert the proportion, a high proportion at least, of the oil that they were exporting to Russia to the south.
That's indeed going to be a challenge also. Our next guest, Carlos Martinez, joins us from London. He is an activist and political analyst. Carlos Martinez, welcome to the program. If we were to take a look at an ulterior motive that the U.S. may have on this, it has pointed to its shale gas. And, of course, that involves fracking. But we know the hazards that are involved with that environmentally. At the same time, the inferior quality that consists of shale gas. How can that even be used to provide shortages, for example, in the case of Europe? Is that even feasible?
Yeah, it's a really important question that's been largely ignored, actually. You know, with the advent of fracking, hydraulic fracturing of shale rock, the U.S. has gone from being an energy importer to being an energy exporter. Now, in terms of the current crisis in Europe, that has a couple of consequences. Firstly, the U.S. isn't really worried so much about sanctioning Russian energy because it's not reliant on it. Secondly, the U.S. gets a positive benefit because it means a bigger market for U.S. energy. That's why the U.S. has been for years trying to scupper the Nord Stream 2 project, because they don't want to see Europe dependent on Russian energy, and they do want to see Europe dependent on American energy. Obviously, for European consumers, this turn to shale is a disaster because fracking is much more expensive. And to be transported across the Atlantic, fracked gas has to be converted to liquid. It has to be stored at, you know, maybe minus 60 degrees centigrade, pumped thousands of kilometers. So that's an expensive process.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we searched and are now ready to present to you some economic news from around the world. Well, you guessed it. It's hard to look for economic news where the Russia-Ukraine conflict is not involved, like this particular piece of news that comes from the UK. UK farmers are warning that soaring gas costs could cut food production. Farmers there are looking at a drop of up to 50% in the amount that they can afford to grow because of the soaring energy costs that are happening in that country. Of course, that's something that the UK is going to be grappling for quite some time. Moving out to the next topic here, premature pullout is the title we've given it. That could be the case of foreign companies that pulled out of Russia. Russia announced it plans to seize assets of Western companies that have pulled out of the country. The Russian President Vladimir Putin preparing economic retaliation for Western sanctions. That includes laws to impound $10 billion of leased airline jets. Russia said it could take temporary control of the departing businesses where foreign ownership exceeds 25%. All right, up to the next crisis. West Asia and North African countries are facing a severe wheat crisis over the Ukraine crisis. West Asia and North African countries are rely heavily on wheat imports from Russia and also from Ukraine, with around 70% of its wheat coming from both of those countries. Some 80% of Tunisia's grain also hails from these two countries. Lebanon, 60% of its wheat comes from Ukraine, so you can see how that obviously spells disaster for those countries when it comes to wheat. Argentina has had a fallout with the IMF before over loans and defaulting on it, but both are eager to get back into it again. But why? In which you have a $45 billion IMF loan that IMF has agreed with that country. Again, there have been loan defaults from Argentina. There was a case back in 1994 where they were heavily involved in a feud when it came to the fact that Argentina felt its sovereignty was violated. The government was going to default on a $19 billion repayment. That's part of the reason why it actually went for that loan. Well, those were the stories that we thought would be okay for this program for us to cover.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
When it comes to the U.S. sanctions on Russia, the U.S. went from being somewhat in doubt or hesitant about sanctioning Russia's oil and energy sector. And then from that, it went to a full-fledged trade embargo. Full-fledged, that meant no Russian imports and no trade with Russia. But at what cost? Did the U.S. really think about that? Well, we're going to be taking a look at some of those aspects. First, we're going to pose this question. How do U.S. sanctions on Russia affect the West? Well, the only way to look at it is through the numbers, and here you have one of them. Russia's oil and gas exports account for 25% of global exports. That's a quarter of global exports Russia accounts for. Next up, the impact on the U.S. It imported an average of over 20.4 million barrels of crude oil and refined petroleum products from Russia, and that was each month for the year 2021, which accounted for 8% of U.S. liquefied fuel imports. As a result, you're looking at the average gasoline price, $4.07 per gallon nationally. In the industry are concerned if it hits $200 per barrel, we may be looking at prices at the pump even going higher than that. And that's a possibility. Inflation is now a concern. The U.S. CPI surged to 7.5% in January, the fastest annual rise in 40 years, with sanctions on Russia putting more pressure, obviously, on inflation. Food, electricity, and shelter, the biggest drivers of inflation. Energy prices, as you can see, up 27%. And Goldman Sachs saying that if oil reaches $150 per barrel, we're looking at even more when it comes to energy costs. Now the EU. Russia is the largest single energy source in the EU. If Russian gas exports are banned, it's going to be tough to bring it from other places. A third of the EU's natural gas and a quarter plus of its crude oil comes from Russia also. There are different aspects to this. But who is going to bear the most brunt, the worst part of it? Germany, the largest economy in Europe, more than half of Germany's natural gas, and over 30% of its crude oil supply comes from Russia. Germany has come out, along with the EU, making a statement that perhaps they're going to put the brakes on banning Russian oil, and they may go in phases. Who knows? They're still a little on one side or the other when it comes to the way that they're going to approach this. Okay. People are bearing the brunt of this. That is what we're focusing on. And here is a case in point, which we obviously are going to take a look at the average people in the U.S. and what they think about what is happening regarding the oil prices and, of course, the conflict in Ukraine.
Not good. The price of gas has gone up. And I got an 8-cylinder engine in here, and I use about $20 every 2 days to try to... I just try to get as much miles as I can out of what I'm doing, you know. But gas prices are going to go up.
And the increase of the gas is keep increasing. Every day it's keep going up. And the jobs are going decent, going down. Every day it's going down. So it's affecting my budget. It's affecting everybody.
I would rather have high gas prices here than an authoritarian regime in the Ukraine. So if we have to suffer with a little bit of inflation and gas prices for a while, to assure that such a wonderful country as Ukraine has an opportunity to develop its democracy, we should do that.
Well, it might be easy for her to say that because I think I saw her pumping actually gasoline into her BMW. Anyways, let's get some analysis into this. We have Attila Boron, who's a political scientist and international analyst, who rejoins us. Attila Boron, Shell producers in the U.S., they stand to obviously benefit from what is going on here. When we take a look at what is happening with sanctions, however, that's what I'd like to focus with you. Do you think that these sanctions that they're placing against Russia is actually going to work in terms of the intended, I guess, purposes that the U.S. has, and in turn the EU, which appears to be following the lead of the U.S.?
Well, you know, I don't think that Mr. Biden has thought over all the implications of these policies of sanctions, because experience shows that sanctions do not work. How many years have been the United States sanctioning other countries? Take the case of Cuba, more than 60 years. Take the case of Iran, 20, 25 years at least. And I don't think this is going to really have a dramatic impact on Russia. Of course, it will create some difficulties to the Russian people, but I don't think that the American expectations, a sort of collapse of Russia because of the sanctions, is not going to happen.
Okay. Well, Carlos Martinez, activist and political analyst, rejoins us from London to understand from him what is happening here. Carlos Martinez, welcome back. You're looking at a situation where European gas prices are trading for what we understand at $500 per barrel. Another stat that's very alarming, 40 million UK citizens heading for fuel poverty. Americans obviously are also kind of suffering, as we just played with gas prices. U.S. may reap the benefits because of its geopolitical intentions, but what about Europeans? First of all, will Russia have oil buyers, and how Europe is going to cope with all of this?
Well, to be honest, I don't know if Europe will cope. 40 million UK citizens in fuel poverty is nearly two-thirds of the population. And obviously, we're not talking about the wealthy. We're talking about ordinary working class and middle-income people who are paying the price of this war in a very real way. You know, ordinary people actually in Britain and Europe benefit not one bit from an escalating war in Ukraine, from NATO's expansion, from aggression against Russia. Actually, given a choice and presented with the facts of the situation, they would much rather have peace in Europe. And there's an opportunity for peace. You know, if NATO is willing to engage on Russia's security concerns, which are not in the least bit unreasonable, then the crisis could end tomorrow. Meanwhile, the imposition of unprecedented, unilateral, illegal sanctions isn't going to bring the war to an end. It's going to extend the war. Meanwhile, it's causing significant suffering for ordinary people in the very countries that are issuing the sanctions. Is it causing suffering in Russia as well? Absolutely. You know, there's no question that these sanctions are going to hit Russian people hard. For all this talk of targeting so-called oligarchs, it's perfectly obvious that if you impose this kind of economic blockade, it's going to impact living standards. However, you look at the list of countries that's sanctioning Russia, it's the usual suspects. It's the US, it's Britain, it's the EU. Meanwhile, China, India, Iran, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, these countries aren't joining in with the sanctions. So Russia does at least have the possibility of bypassing this crisis to some degree.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed an immediate ban on Russian oil and other energy imports. Sanctions on Russia's oil and gas industry had once been viewed as mostly off the table, as officials in the U.S. and Europe were worried about a global spike in prices. The United Kingdom said that it would phase out imports of Russian oil and oil products by the year 2022, while the European Union said it would slash Russian gas imports to Europe by 66% by the end of the year.
By the end of this year, we can replace 100 BCM of gas imports from Russia. That is two-thirds of what we import from them. This will end our over-dependence